Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat 56 for, what is today, April 1st, how could I forget that, 2010. This is Mike Woloff, and tonight we're covering two topics. We're going to do a post-discussion about CSUN 2010 and kind of find out the likes, dislikes, and get three different perspectives on that event. Then a little bit later, we're going to talk a little bit about the new XP mode in the professional and ultimate versions of Windows 7, allowing you to run a copy of XP underneath at no additional charge. And we'll talk about why you would want to do that. But it's a very cool feature. I've done it on two machines, including one with only 1 gig of RAM. So not that I'd recommend doing it that way, but it can be done. But we're going to start off. We have a panel of three folks joining us tonight. We have from Canada there, we have taking care of the citizens with disabilities for Ontario. We have Jeffrey Stark. And Jeffrey attended quite a few sessions. We also have J.J. Medall, who blindbargains.com. You'll know him from that space. He, in addition to the 27 interviews I did, he brought another 20 to the table. Many were different. So, but you listen between the two of us, you're going to get quite a perspective of different events taking place. And finally, joining us, Raul Gallegos with GW Micro, and he's going to talk about what it was like coming at this from the vendor perspective and also doing some training seminars, and we'll find out kind of what things people ask about and get out of these training seminars and how effective that is to take that on as a company. I'm going to start with you, Jeff, and I want you to talk about some of the sessions that you attended and kind of what you learned, what you got out of this year's 2010, or maybe what you see are some of the upcoming trends in technology.
Well, I can definitely say that there were far more sessions than any one person could sit through in their whole conference going. I had a pretty full agenda. Most of my stuff was looking at how web accessibility is evolving. I would definitely say that on that front, the big topic with all the various sessions, there were at least 24 sessions on the topic, were related to the new Web Content Accessibility Standards, which are the 2.0 that came out last year, and the new ARIA draft standards, which allow an application to, hopefully will allow sites like Facebook and other very rich desktop-like applications to be accessible. So from that side, a lot of my sessions were primarily more of a development side, but I did sit in on a number of interesting sessions on the product side, including one for a product called Wearabraille, which essentially was a glove that you could put on each hand, and they had little sensors like they have in the iPhone that would be attached to the fingers and would allow someone wearing this Wearabraille type device to use any surface as a Braille keyboard. So essentially you could be sitting on the bus and type out your message on the window of the bus, or sitting in a class and type out on the bottom of the table or top of the table to enter data. I think that was probably the most cool research project I saw as far as items. I would definitely say that the idea of typing on any surface is certainly an interesting one. Attended a number related to GPS products. It would seem that a lot of the sessions favor the Sendero offerings in one form or another, but I think a lot of that's also because there aren't too many options at this point on mainstream devices beyond Sendero offerings. And then on the exhibit hall, I can either talk about that now or later, if you'd like there, Michael.
Okay, we'll come back to the exhibit hall. This Braille glove sounds like a good idea, unless it's the leg of the lady sitting next to you on the bus. You might not be too fond of that. But
well, she might enjoy that, you know?
Well, she may. But Raul, let's get things from your perspective. I know you spent quite a bit of time at your booth at GW Micro, so give us a vibe on kind of what things people are asking, but then also talk about what it's like to conduct sessions, what kind of turnout you had, and how helpful that is to you as a business.
Well, the booth was definitely very busy. As you know, we've got some new products that we were showcasing, and so The way we had our booth set up was, rather than having a table or two, is we had an island. So it's essentially like four booths, and so we have four different stations, and then a table in the middle. And each different station that we have is a different category of the stuff we have. So we had a window eye station, and then we had a low vision station, which, you know, has all our sense view magnifiers and that kind of stuff. And then we had one specific for the book sense Daisy reader, and then one for the note takers. And I mainly manned the note taker one, and it was one of the busiest ones out of the others because of the new voice sense. And so coming at it from the vendor's point of view, I can definitely say that it takes a lot more energy. And it's a lot more intense when you're presenting as opposed to when you're attending as a visitor. And so I believe that doing this really helps out because it gives people a chance to physically look at a product, feel it, hold it, check it out, that type of stuff. And you get to setting the products aside, you also get to what I hear a lot of time is, you know, Raul, I see you on email a lot, and, you know, I see the kind of stuff you guys do, and yada, 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 but now it's good to, you know, put a voice to the personality, I guess. So, you know, now I'm not Raul Gallegos, you know, according to Eloquence or anything like that. You know, now I'm an actual person. And so I think it really helps like that because it helps us keep in touch with our customers a little bit better.
I would agree with that. That's one of the things I enjoy most is meeting many people that I either talk to on the phone or correspond via email or even talk to on Samnet chats and even through Cyril Talk. You actually meet them face to face. So that's a really cool thing there. JJ, you, like myself, made the Whirlwind Tour and came in and did a number of interviews. I'm curious on your perspectives. What impressed you and what left you scratching your head going, okay, and I would spend money on that? What's your take?
Sure. There's several things that impressed me at CSUN, one of which, unfortunately, doesn't seem to be available for consumers at this point. There's an incriminating recording that I made of me doing a Braille karaoke. And what that basically is a Sika Braille display attached to one of the commercial karaoke machines. And basically, whenever the lyrics were to come up on the screen, they would pop up on the display in grade 2 Braille. So it's one of those things that, to many people, it would seem like a very minimalist invention or activity, but I think many blind people would understand how cool this would be as far as social integration if you could actually go to a place or to a karaoke night somewhere and be able to fit in and not have to memorize the lyrics or bring a Braille copy. You could just do it like everybody else. So that's one of those things, unfortunately, they don't seem to have at this moment a consumer version of that. It was more kind of just an exhibit hall wow factor demo. So it would actually be kind of cool if it could be taken further. As far as disappointments, I'm seeing a lot of just copycat innovations and inventions. I guess they wouldn't be innovations. Just seeing a lot of copycat companies, and I'm sure this is nothing new, but how many portable reading machines can we possibly support? And the same goes with the Daisy players. Those two markets have gone from having one or two innovators at the beginning to having a complete flood of options. And, you know, granted, there are some that will make their little difference. The PlexTalk Pocket having the wireless support, the Daisy players, and so there are some exceptions to that rule, but there are just way too many of the same thing now. And I'm thinking over the next year or two, there's just not going to be room for all these, and at least one or two of them is going to kind of fall by the wayside.
Well, and that brings up two interesting points. A, we both did interviews, and you actually had a demo of the Blio reader. So two concerns there are, A, when this product comes out with a couple hundred thousand and allegedly ultimately 1 million books, what's going to happen if the technology can't be utilized on these book players that people are purchasing in droves? Are they going to be upset customers, or might it be possible that other technologies will be able to harness that? Maybe Bookshare or RFB&D will be able to tap into that as well. And as you pointed out, is the blind community in large part ready to start paying for books?
Sure, and that's a big thing with Bleel, and that's going to be a huge shift for just about every blind person who's used to having every book available to them for free. Now, the trade-off is, with Bleel, you'll be able to theoretically have books available on the same day, which is something that, other than some selected audiobooks over at Audible and some other sources, wasn't widely available before. So will blind people be willing to pay for this privilege? I think there's many cases where they will be, especially when it comes to the best-selling new books, the possibility of having access to magazines when they are first released. That does offer a lot of potential. Will Bleel endanger the current crop of Daisy readers? I think it'll provide competition, but those Daisy readers do provide a lot of other sources of information, everything from the NFB newsline in your pocket to SAMNet content to being able, you know, some of them have radios on them and many other things. So I think there's enough other functions in the Daisy players that even though if they don't play Bleel, there will still be enough market for them.
That's a good perspective. And what are your thoughts on Braille? I saw a Braille printer, a Braille print combo machine that made no extra noise. I mean, it was even quieter than my LaserJet sitting in front of me, and it did Braille and print. Also, you did an interview about something called Braille 2000, some Braille translation software that you can actually lease. So what did you see in the Braille space?
That's an interesting item. The Braille 2000 is from a computer application specialties company. I think they needed a shorter name for the company. And while there's, you know, maybe not a lot special about their software, and it actually might need a little bit of work on accessibility, according to the programmer, they are leasing it for $26 a month. And looking at GW Micro and Serotech and a couple other companies who have done lease to own in the past, it's refreshing to see that come to Braille translation. Especially for a small business who maybe is looking to get into starting a translation operation and normally would have to spend several hundred dollars for Duxbury or buy a Braille printer that has an included driver. So this is definitely a refreshing option, $26 a month, and that would include all the updates as long as you stay with your lease.
Now, you were excited about some new Canon copiers that have built in OCR to PDF conversion. So what did you see in that space? Why were you impressed with these units from Canon?
The reason I'm impressed with Canon is it sounded like when we first heard about this Canon copier initiative that it was going to be one copier and it was going to be quite a bit more expensive. And looking at it a little bit closer, it seems what they're doing is they're starting to add accessibility add-ons to many of their copiers. Now, of course, the ultimate solution would have to have that built in and not pay extra for it. But as a compromise at this point, it's good to see when you have a $500 to $1,000 add-on and a $20,000 product, that really isn't a lot. It does add features, like you said, text-to-speech, OCR, so you know you can scan and actually convert the PDF right inside the copier. Everything talks, and it's also very ergonomically friendly for those with other disabilities. And I think Canon is starting to realize that by adding a lot of these accessibility features, it's also benefiting their mainstream market. Other people like it when their machines talk to them, too, and it makes it a little easier. They don't always have to look down at the screen. Most of your Canon products are intended for businesses, so they would be leased. So the cost of accessibility might only come up to an extra buck or two a month, and you might even be able to get the company leasing to you to just to eat that cost. So it really wouldn't cost you any extra to have an accessibility system in your office.
Now, you seemed a little bothered or concerned about an $1,100 Braille labeler, which sounds a bit much, but if this is a technology, again, that a business could lease or can do high-quality production, so that means increased amount of Braille on CDs, DVDs, and other items that we may purchase, might there be some benefit, or describe this product?
There might be some benefit. It's a portable, semi-portable Braille labeling machine that prints on tape that is similar to Dymo, but not Dymo labeling tape. It's made by KGS, who is a company in Japan that actually makes a lot of the Braille displays, or the cells for them. Connects via USB and runs on software. So you type in what you want Braille, then it will Braille it out. It ain't even that fast, so you expect for $1,100, it would whiz out 50 labels a minute. The speed wasn't that much faster than it would be someone typing it by themselves on a Brailler. And for just one-line labels for $1,100, you better be needing a lot of labels to justify a cost like that. It's imported here by Enabling Technologies.
Now I want to go to the question, ask all three of you, what are your thoughts on the new location versus Los Angeles? I know, JJ, you're initial thought was it was cool, but there needs to be a little more space for exhibitors. Whereas in the past, we had two buildings that were, what, 5-6 blocks apart. But I want to hear from each of you your thoughts on the new versus the old location.
Sure. As far as the new location, now I did not go to the old location, so everything that I got was just based on hearsay and from other people. But I know there were several exhibitors that were not did not have room to exhibit this year, and it's unfortunate because you'd want to, if you're coming to a major conference, see every single exhibitor. So maybe GW Micro could give up part of their island or some of these other bigger tables, make a little bit of room. Just so we could fit everybody in, or maybe there's another spot at that hotel that you could do that. Other than that, the facility seemed very nice, and I'll let the other two speak to how it compares to L.A.
Okay, we'll start with you. Well, what did you think in terms of attendance? Was it down because maybe you had a smaller population of locals, or is pretty much everyone coming, traveling in from other places, or what was your thought?
My thinking is that the attendance was actually down as far as, I don't have any actual numbers to show anything. So this is just on perception. It seemed like the majority of the people that attended were more, regional type. California, Oregon area, Nevada, and the surrounding states. I don't believe I really talked to very many people, from the Midwest or from the East Coast or from south, and so it seemed like it was mainly west. As far as the exhibits go, when comparing it to the Los Angeles location, a lot of the things that I would hear as far as the other, coming from the other side of the spectrum is that people didn't like being separated up into two buildings. They wanted to try to have something that was, in the same exhibit hall. Of course, there probably is that trade-off, like what JJ was saying, that there's might be less space for some, and it's one of those situations where they may not be able to accommodate everyone's needs. Although, me personally, this is my own personal opinion, I don't know why they couldn't have kept it in Los Angeles and maybe at a convention center in Los Angeles as opposed to changing the whole city. But as far as the hotel and the location here in San Diego, it was very nice. The staff was great. Very spacious hotel in general. And it actually wasn't too difficult to get around, if you're totally blind or whatever, and getting around to the different areas. It was relatively easy, so that at least I thought was very important for someone that might be traveling around in different parts of the hotel.
Well, Jeffrey, you've attended a few. What was your perspective?
Well, I can definitely say that I found it to be an extremely positive move as far as both the accessibility of the location and the less disability-oriented accessibility of the location. The LAX venue, you had it separated into two hotels, and really, most people spent the bulk of their time at sort of the main hotel, being most often the Marriott. And almost nobody went over to the other hotel, which was across Century Boulevard, a four-lane, very busy, very fast road with no audible pedestrian signal. So essentially, they found that their traffic was much, much lower in that building for both the sessions and the booths that they ran or exhibit area that they ran there. So you were kind of viewed as a second-class citizen if you ended up in the, what was that hotel called? It began with an R, whatever it was. But essentially, you were kind of in a poor location. What I can definitely say about the new location is it's a lot better laid out. There's a lot more to do after hours. They have a lot more space to do things after hours, because while there were a lot of sessions during the day, there were just as many evening activities. Everything from the tweet-up, which went on, I believe, on the Wednesday, all the way to receptions, to meet-and-greets, to vendor events. So there were a lot more break-off rooms, and I think that probably increased the value of the activity. Because, a conference is not just about seeing new equipment and not just about going to sessions, but it's about networking with people. So being able to make those links and have those conversations and have it in a setting where you can have a little bit less formal experience with someone. I think that's really important. So yes, I would say it's definitely A, the most connected time that this conference has gone on, in that people were tweeting and they did live broadcasts of things like the tweet up and such. And also on the opposite point, probably one of the largest, and you never hit everything this session, whereas at previous activities you could pretty much hit everything that was going on because there wasn't a lot of variety in any given one day. So
I was impressed. I mean, definitely next year I want to get more involved in the sessions. There are so many sessions, so much stuff going on that it's truly amazing. A lot of work goes into getting the different speakers and presenters, and of course some have some post follow-up notes that you can go and browse. But and, you know, Jeff, I'm on the page right now, I'm showing specifically the low vision exhibits, and of course there are many other categories that they have as well. But anything there catch your attention? I know there was one in particular that of course affects me personally, but there's a movement now to make the new described videos with synthetic speech as a way, I guess, to get them out faster rather than hiring or paying human narrators that can just type up the appropriate and mark it up in DAISY or some technology. What do you know? Do any of you know about that?
Well, I can just quickly say that one thing about the sessions is that they are very well categorized, in that you can pretty much spend an entire conference going through one topic area, like blind and low vision, or cognitive, or web development, or any of those things. So as far as someone coming, you can definitely find something that catches your interest. I would say the one advantage to the text-to-speech approach to DVS is the fact that you can then adjust the speed at which it speaks to you, so you can get more information into that smaller sort of space. That interests you.
Well, it's interesting, or a lot of the ones in the UK where they greatly drop the audio when they're narrating and keep popping it up and down, drive some folks nuts. But so what was your space? Were you kind of in the web development, the internet space?
Is that's kind of my background, so that's where I spent a lot of time, especially from the perspective that there's a lot of hype about something called ARIA, and it was really interesting to see how little support there actually is for ARIA in the actual AT area. So,
well, but that's
I think
some,
that was pretty eye-opening.
That's a mixed bag, though, isn't it? Because you have ARIA, but you have companies attempting to deploy it that really aren't doing it correctly. So do the screen readers spend a lot of time and then have negative issues because the companies aren't implementing it correctly? But what are you seeing there? What's the future? You know, are we going to get put backward?
I think we're
going to
be going into desktop, right? I mean, that's what everybody wants on the web, is the open quote desktop experience, where you basically get windows popping up and sliding in and sliding out and so on. And the only way to get that information purveyed to a screen reader or to any AT is to have some way to actually define it. And that's the good thing about ARIA. The bad thing is that it's a specification, and until such time as there's a fair bit of implementation, it really won't be a thing we can rely on.
All right, so you said Google's diving into it, right? Gmail and Google Docs, and now even they're using Ajax to embed their search results right into the, you know, as soon as you type in your search query without even updating the page or loading a new page. So we're seeing it, I don't know about Facebook, it's been a real thorn in the sides of many of us, and they keep changing it, so maybe they're having issues trying to come up with their ultimate UI. And it's not just blind folks, sighted folks get kind of frustrated with it as well.
Well, I think that's definitely one of the values of ARIA, is the fact that a developer can say, where previously it was all just one web page, or one web site, or web application, and a developer can now say what each of the objects are that they're putting on the screen. They can say whether or not it's something that a screen reader or any AT needs to know about. They can also say when those changes happen on the screen, because right now, if something changes on the screen reader does exactly what you don't want it to do and sends you back to the top of the page rather than to the new information.
I've just opened up questions, so folks can, for now, submit text questions, and then in a few minutes we'll open up voice questions, and I'll have to relay those to prevent a feedback loop. But in the meantime, there was a whole category of legal issues. Did you see anything in that space?
Well, I think Section 508 did a whole day's worth of hearings at the CSUN venue. So persons with disabilities, IT developers, and web developers had an opportunity to speak about what their concerns were.
And you were there? What did you see in that space?
I would definitely say that there's a lot of confusion right now, especially with the new standards that the government, U.S. government, is looking at putting into play. And that they're looking at providing a more future-ready set of standards so that they're not limited in the way that right now, well, Section 508 is very much not geared towards some of the more modern practices on technology and such. So they're looking at a more agnostic approach to accessibility, which will leave some people scratching their head.
So we're changing the standards again. You know, who has it that said the best thing about standards is that there's so many of them?
Mm-hmm. And just to get back to sort of, you'd asked about some of the technology that was out on the exhibit hall, and I would definitely say that from a Canadian perspective, where we have English and French material often that we have to read that's often on the same page, I agree with JJ that there was a ton, an absolute ton of sort of camera reading devices where basically you have an arm, a camera attached to it, and it's plugged into a computer. But one product that definitely caught our eye was this thing called the Read It, Read It Scholar. And essentially this thing, you could have multi-language documents in one page, so English, French, and German, for example, all written on the same page, and this thing would do language detection real-time in the OCR. So it would switch back and forth with the text-to-speech engine from English to French to German and back again, which I thought was just phenomenal, quite frankly.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because my thought is, I mean, there's two main background engines as far as doing the conversion, so is there really that much difference? But that sold you on that one, is the multiple languages on one page, a lot of manuals and just different documents.
Every one of our government forms, every one of our publications from federal, municipal, or local governments have to be published in both languages, so it's not unusual to see a mixed bag of language on the page. And that just, I don't know if you've ever heard a French piece of text being read by an English text-to-speech engine, but it totally butchers it to the point of unreadability.
Yeah, we want a sexy French female reading French, don't we? Yes, we do. Well, we've been able to voice questions. So again, F9 is your push-to-talk key. So just press it and just quickly state your name, and then we'll call on you in turn. And see, what about, okay, our first question is coming in. Let's see what we have here. Was there any hint at CSUN about the drop in the price of Braille displays? Now, JJ, I know you talked about a new Seika coming in 80 cells under 5,000. Did any of you see anything in the Braille display arena as far as lower prices or innovations?
I didn't see anything new, or don't have any information on that.
I would say there wasn't a lot that was cheap. There never seems to be in the Braille area, but the open driver initiative is about the only thing that the open Braille initiative is about the only thing noteworthy in that area, I think.
Can I be heard?
How about you, JJ?
Yes.
I think we lost.
Sorry,
I
there. You're lost. I lost. Away from lost. You're time. There, buddy.
Well, you have the Focus 40 for $27.95, and it sounds like that Seika Bluetooth is going to be less than that, or very close to it. So maybe we finally. It used to be $100 per cell, so maybe we're finally down a little bit below that, but we got a long ways to go.
Yeah, 60, 70 bucks a cell, but a ways to go. But that would be answer to that question. Again, any text questions, you can submit those, or F9 is your push-to-talk key, and we'll kind of see But in a few minutes, we're going to switch over to talk about this XP mode on Windows 7, which I've used with System Access and Window Eyes and even NVDA. Have any of you played with that?
I have, only very briefly with NVDA.
Okay, well,
I haven't played with it with Window Eyes.
Well, you'll be glad to know it works. I had no issue at all with 7.1, 7.1.1, and 7.2 Beta 1. So, Raul, let me ask you, I got a few vague answers about 7.2 and 8.0. What can you tell us about what's coming down the pike there?
Well, we've been simultaneously working on getting 7.2 and 8.0 out. We wanted to, initially we were going to just focus on, 8.0 or, we're calling it 8.0 for now, but, numbers can change at the last minute. But then we also wanted to have support for Office 2010 and the iTunes 9.1 because they changed, between their 9.0, which broke the iTunes store and that kind of stuff. So rather than making people wait until a whole new major upgrade was out, we decided to go ahead and release 7.2, or rather, work on that to release it, which is maybe a few weeks away. And so that's where that's looking at, and it's going to be the last version. This is what we're projecting, is it's going to be the last version in the 7 series. And then from that, once we have 7.2 out, we're going to concentrate strictly on the next major upgrade, which is going to have, a lot of nice things. One of the biggest things that it's going to have that I can say is that browse mode is essentially getting rewritten. Browse mode was, the concept of MSAA mode and browse mode with many AT out there was designed for a website that was pretty much, staying the same. Now with things being dynamic and being the way they are, browse mode, the way it works, and what was mentioned earlier, if something changes halfway down the page, a lot of times, most cases, browse mode takes you to the top of the buffer because it refreshes. And so, things like that, and anything with new dynamic content, and the way everything is handled on web pages is going to be redone. And so that's what we're looking at.
That's why I heard a lot of ARIA, a lot of web, web-based stuff in 8.0.
Right. Yep, exactly. And, of course, the scripting support of Window Eyes, which we introduced in version 7, is constantly being enhanced. We're adding new capabilities, new things to further enhance the abilities that you, the script writer, can have. And, as you know, Window Eyes scripting is essentially an OpenCom automation, so that any scripting language that supports OpenCom automation will be able to be used to write scripts for Window Eyes. And so we're just expanding that even further, and we're planning some pretty nice things.
Well, very good. Final round of questions for anyone before we move on to XP mode here in Windows 7, and all three of you are welcome to stay around or jump off if you want, but I'm pretty excited about this Windows 7 XP mode. It's a really cool technology, and it's great that the screen readers seem to be working with it. I can't comment on one of them because I don't have a copy and don't know if it would have any issues. But as I said, the others migrate over to it very well. Jeff, any final thoughts you want to have? Because you were there the longest, I suspect. You were there a week in San Diego, kind of.
Oh, yes. Pre-conference sessions, full sessions, and then things at the end.
So talk about the pre-conference. I mean, what percentage of people would you say actually come to the pre-conference, and how is that different from when things open up into general and the people arrive and the exhibitors and so forth?
So the regular sessions are about half an hour in length, some a little longer, some a little shorter. So they don't really get an opportunity to cover things in great detail, whereas the pre-conference sessions are more of a training opportunity. They're either half a day or a full day, and there are topics, everything from introduction to assistive technology, which is good for someone who's just starting to get into this kind of a field, who wants to know what's out there and what they should know on that topic, all the way over to some of the I did a full day session on ARIA and rich internet application development. So, you know, you get a nice mix of very topic specific areas. I know that one of my colleagues sat in on a session that compared OCR engines and spent half a day going through them. So,
well, who would have thunk?
OCR system.
Who would have thunk?
So there's lots to choose from.
Yeah, there's definitely a wealth of stuff to do there. One thing I want to talk to you about that we discussed earlier was the difference that Canadians have in purchasing their own access technology. One thing I like, and I'll probably get some hate mail for this, but every so often, every 3 years or something, you said that basically you can get a government-subsidized upgrade in your access technology, but consumers do pay a certain percentage of it, which I think is good because that forces them to get involved in the decision-making process and look at all the screen-reading technology and the Braille display technology and the OCR technology, because part of it's coming out of their pocket. And I see that as a good thing, but how does that program work in Canada?
Well, every province has their own system, and I can't talk to all of them, but I can definitely talk to the Ontario side of things. In Ontario, we have something called the Assistive Devices Program, and you nailed it right on the hood, which is that essentially you get authorized for certain categories of products, and you can go to the pot once every 5 years, so your purchase is expected to last 5 years, so you want to make an intelligent choice about what you're going for. You get authorized for something, like let's say a Braille display or a CCTV. You know, CCTV isn't cheap. They come in generally between $3,000 and $5,000. So that might be outside of the financial means of some people. Once you've got it authorized, you basically then can choose your vendor, which is the first important piece, choose your products, and you are responsible to pay 25% of the cost of the total package, which includes your computer, which includes your monitor in some cases, which could include a scanner or printer, which can include a CCTV or a DAISY reader, or I believe a OCR system. And so from that side, it's a nice nice approach to this, because just as you
said,
what
about SMAs?
It means that you have a direct interest in what you're getting, you have a direct say in what you're getting, and you're spending money out of pocket, so you kind of make those decisions intelligently.
But JJ asked, what about SMAs?
Well, on the SMA front, you do have to pay for it out of pocket. So
they're not included in that. It's 100% if you want that additional, which is kind of the way it's become here in the States. They used to be subsidized. Well, I guess that's a state-by-state kind of thing, but a lot of states have gotten away from SMAs. At least Indiana has. I don't know about what percentage out of the 50 states. But
we tend to have more loan programs here.
Yeah, so that means you could have some very obsolete technology on your desk after near the end of the 4 or 5 years of your time.
So we tend to have more loan programs, it seems, in this country than outright grants. The only thing I wonder about the grants, and that, you know, is the same thing in Europe, you know, that we have the government programs here, and do those programs combined help to keep the, you know, costs up for us? That's, you know, the only perhaps negative byproduct of a program like that.
Well, certainly government procurement can elevate the prices, and of course they don't generally lease, at least the U.S. government. They either buy it outright or they don't. So that probably does keep the prices up to some extent. And of course you have some companies who solely work, rely on the government, and some that kind of sit in the middle and get government and consumer and purchasers, and then companies like Cerotech that have a little bit, but very little government purchases. Most are consumers paying 100% out of their pocket. So that certainly does dictate the prices. But right, you have in Europe, my understanding that, you know, the government gets all their students, and blind folks are entitled to Braille displays. So certainly the literacy rate's a little higher there. But right, does that inflate those prices, because they know, you know, they've got a sure thing there. They produce them, and they know a certain number of these units will be sold. A lot of good points there.
I know Germany definitely pays for equipment and so on. So,
and that's why you see quite a few folks in the German space, exactly.
But it also means that there's a German industry there, too. I mean, 90% of the good Braille comes out, or Braille devices and Braille systems tend to flourish in that market and come out of that market.
That's a good point. So it feeds the industry in general.
Mm-hmm. I will definitely say one quick thing, which is that System Access is definitely ADP approved. So it is definitely an option that Ontarians have when they go to buy their screen reader choice.
Now, how does that work as far as, do they say, well, you should get this or you should get that, or do you go to a center and see all of the existing technologies available, or does it depend? I know you said it varies between provinces, but does it depend on who you talk to? Do some say, well, if you work and use this particular application, you need this screen reader, or is there more user
involvement? I'm sure opinion comes into it. I'm sure that when you go to speak to someone, you're going to definitely get part of their opinion. You definitely get the opportunity to have a look at these things firsthand, which is a good thing. And, I mean, it's going to vary from location to location.
Yeah, it just concerns me when, and I heard this the other day when someone says, and I won't name the company, but I think I would recommend this particular screen reader because that's the one I know. And that just wrenches my gut. You know, if it's the best for what they need, that's fine. But if someone's just too lazy to learn alternate technologies and let that person see instead of assuming that's going to be the best for their needs, that bothers me. And I don't know what it's going to take to change that. But a lot of advocacy and government fiscal responsibility, I suppose.
That's pretty much what it comes down to.
Yeah. Exactly. Anything else before I pop
up
the...
You didn't mention the GW Micro. I was very privileged to sit in on the GW Micro product launch reception or whatever on the Thursday.
Wednesday evening.
Yeah, and I have to say, any one thing that amused me most was the fact that they basically said that the unit was very durable, and the crowd said, well, then throw it. And so dude actually lifted it up above his head and threw it down on the ground, the voice sense, and powered it on afterwards. So,
well, it was light. You know. I mean, it's about the weight of like a calculator or something. I mean, the thing is just so light. Now, let's see if it's on concrete. But.
Yeah, very light, very thin, I think was the two things that people were very impressed about it. And it's definitely survived the drop test for sure.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I thought the forthcoming book, since DS was going to have a large enough screen to support a lot of partially sighted folks, because my thought always was that a lot of these book readers, you know, without having a screen, go solely after the totally blind market, and that's maybe 1 in 8. Most folks have some vision, but I guess this device is a little bit more in the LD space, or what level of vision, what level of sight are you going to have to be able to use that screen, and what information is offered on that screen?
You pretty much have it correct in that the idea behind the BookSense DS is not so much to target a low vision market or a partially sighted. I hate all these politically correct terms, but it is more for the LD market. So, even setting aside the LD market, it also the idea behind it as well is for maybe TVIs who are working with a blind student, and they want to be able to show them, you know, where certain things are or whatever, because if a TVI is, even though he or she may be a teacher visually impaired, that person may be sighted, and most sighted people are visual learners. And so unless they've really gotten 100% comfortable with an audio-only device, a lot of times when they press a certain arrow key, sure, they might be able to hear it, but they may have that comfort zone knowing that, okay, I pressed a down arrow, it's highlighting item X, and oh, there it is on the screen, so I'm definitely sure now. So I think that's also part of it, too. So we're the BookSense DS is really targeting both an LD market and also, you know, in...
Okay, I hope I didn't lose audio from everyone. I'm going to assume that someone's still there. But George McDermott asked the question, will the voice sense eventually have an attached Braille display, and how much will that impact the price?
The Sync Braille display that we have is going to work with the voice sense. It's not physically attached, but it will attach via USB.
So you make some kind of case that could actually house both units and transfer away, or how would you?
We have right now for the voice sense, for the original voice sense, the BT, I guess, if you want to call it, we have a combo case that puts the voice sense and Sync Braille together. And so I would imagine that something like that will be designed, although that's certainly not in place right now.
The other part of that equation with the voice sense is that HIMSS in Korea, South Korea, has been talking about an 18-cell model. And
do we still have audio?
So they have,
yes.
You know, GW, of course.
Oh, okay,
we talked
gotcha.
To Roe. He's not so, saying much about
It's something that we hope to have in place.
Hold on,
so right
hold on.
Now,
we got two of you. Maybe you can't hear each other. So JJ jumped in saying HIMSS says that there's an 18-cell display that they're bringing to the... So go ahead and finish, JJ, and I'll go back to Roe.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm kind of on my own little planet now since I got lost on Skype. HIMSS is... has leaked some information about an 18-cell voice sense. I asked Raul about it last week, and of course, you know, GW, you can't say anything about it yet, but that's something to, it looks like, you know, if it comes here, definitely could be another option as far as combining the Braille display and the same features as the new voice sense.
Well, and speaking of disclosure, I know GW told me there was no price available for the BookSense DS, and HIMSS told me right up front $499, but there was nothing yet for the VoiceSense QWERTY. Do we have prices on that yet? I don't know if I lost Raul here, but
I'm here. Sorry about that. What we're targeting is going to be right around the $499 range, and it's not set in stone, and it could change at any moment, but the reason it's being targeted to around that is essentially the BookSense DS, feature for feature, is the same as the BookSense XT, which also retails for $499. Both have the 4 gigs of internal storage and the radio. The difference is that you're going to trade in the Bluetooth for the display.
Right, so that's the choice that you have to make and decide which is most important to you. Are you concerned that the iPad is going to affect your market? Now here you've got this larger display. You got a tool for partials to come in. The book reader is going to, I believe, have pretty much the same functionality as Blio, but you're going to have this display and scrolling capabilities. Are you concerned about it, or just have to cross that path when it comes up?
I think we'll just end up crossing that path.
Yeah, very good. What do you think, Jeff? Has Canada adopted Apple or Macintosh products, or have they not really proven themselves yet? They themselves, Apple has used the term competitors, so they're looking at Cerotech and GW Micro and Freedom Scientific as competition. So I'd be curious to see, if they do make their way into the federal and state government space, or what happens in terms of users.
Well, I can definitely say that I think that people have been a little reluctant to move to the Mac just simply because of the learning curve. You know, you're starting from scratch if you already know something. But I think that it's definitely an option. It is definitely covered. It is definitely something that I have heard a number of people have purchased. So, for sure, it's something that's in the market and out there.
Okay, George asks another question, and I'm glad he brought this up. For JJ, it says, Blind Bargains will begin charging for its services, as is the case with Blio. It says, do you think people are willing to pay for quality information services? And JJ, talk about that decision, because I know I myself am seeing that increased cost in putting these podcasts. And I mean, it costs well over a minimum of $1,000 just to travel out to CSUN or ATIA. So talk about
there are a lot of costs that come into doing the various conventions. Of course, there was the story going around about me staying at a $26 hostel, you know, which has its advantages, but also was a little bit away from the conference site. But even just with airfare and food and everything else, you know, if you want to try to attend three or four of these a year, the costs do go up. So it came down to either have to find advertisers or we have to, you know, charge a subscription. Now, we've talked about a $49 annual subscription or $4.99 a month for Blind Bargains. It's also April 1st. My bargains will always be free. And there you go. You hear it here now. It's been a fun day, but we are still free.
Oh, you got us, buddy. Oh, you got us. Someone asked if anyone pulled one on me, and I said no. There you go. Well, you know, it was interesting because you get the best of both worlds. You can throw it out as a joke, and then you can see what people say. So
I was actually waiting to see if you had actually fallen for that one.
Yeah, I think I had, but I thought, you know, I have to admit to it. I guess we all did. I don't know we all, but some all did.
Well, would you like to buy any Braille dots?
Yeah, I want some Braille dots.
That was good.
Yeah, that was a good one, Raul. Braille dots. Definitely.
So I have a quick question there. Did anybody else miss the click and go? The lack of a click and go maps option at CSUN?
Well, it would have been nice. I fortunately this time had a good sighted counterpart, and we actually rented a vehicle and were able to travel and do some things. But I think it would have been nice, and Joe was actually there with Click and Go Maps, and we're going to be talking to him in an upcoming podcast about some other projects. So it would have been nice because there was so much in walking distance that, you know, it would have made a nice addition, and maybe next year we can get it done. It was kind of a strange opposition that said, oh, no, people want to get up and meet at the concierge desk at 6:30 in the morning and walk around as a big group and try to figure things out. Not.
I heard blind people don't want to be handheld was the line that I had heard from someone.
Well, maybe someone had a vested interest in doing it that way or was compensated to do that. I don't know what the logic was, but yeah, that would have been nice, and that's a cool service, and hopefully that'll be available at the conventions, and we'll ask Joe about that. But he was definitely there, and I got the vibe that maybe they are open to it in the future. So, again, if that's something...
Well, we had the pleasure of working with Joe in Click and Go for the ATIA 2009 in Chicago, and we handed out SD cards that had all the Click and Go map stuff all set, and it was great. I mean, it was a good opportunity to explore this, and I certainly got a lot out of it for the ATIA.
Yeah, it was very helpful, and you needed it there because the way the buildings were kind of in a circular fashion, it was definitely helpful.
I was trying to get to the Euphoria room, and I ended up in the Epiphany room. You know, it was just a weird experience.
You had an epiphany.
Had an epiphany before and after Euphoria. There you go. Well, I want to take our final 7 minutes here and talk about this Windows XP mode. I've got it up on the screen. Those of you following along with the accessible event, I will give the URL. It's Microsoft.com/Windows/Virtual-PC. And essentially what this is, it doesn't work for the home versions, but if you use Pro or Ultimate versions, there's a drop-down. You can make sure that your version is covered. But essentially, you click on the download link from this page or just add a /download.aspx to the URL. But basically, there's three components to it. There's an installer. It's just under 500 meg. That is the actual copy of Windows XP. And then there's two additional files that you install, whether your Windows 7 is either 32 or 64-bit. And I also learned I wasted quite a bit of time that it's helpful if you're using the pop-up blocker to go in and add Microsoft.com as an allowed site so that you can actually download the files. A little frustrating if you don't do that. But essentially what you have here, and I'm going to try to demo it here if technically possible. What I will have to do is, there we go, we'll close that. Basically, you go into your... I'll turn it up here a little bit. You go into your once you install these three components, and of course there's also a validation to make sure you have a genuine, legitimate copy of Windows 7, and you don't pay any extra for it. Obviously, you need to install another instance of your screen reader to make it work, but essentially you go in your start menu and you go up to Windows Virtual PC, you expand it, and there's something called XP mode, and then you run that the first time, and then it will actually finish the install process for you, and then you can actually, basically, you have a clean copy of Windows XP, and I will run that for you and just show you. Basically, what I did is right-clicked and made a desktop shortcut.
Desktop list recycle XP size 1.48.
And I call it XP. So now it's actually going to launch a copy
Windows
of Windows
XP mode, Windows Virtual PC, starting the virtual machine, 0%.
And we will actually do a greater 2%. Demo on this on the April 12th podcast because I want to go into it into a little greater 5%. Detail than time permits. But it's a very fast process. It installed on this 8%. Machine in about 5 minutes, and I think on my slower laptop 11%. It was maybe 10 to 12 minutes, but still pretty impressive. But essentially, once you get into 13%. Windows XP, one of the first things you're going to want to do or get in advance is a copy of IE8, because this includes 16%. Windows Service Pack 3, but what you do not get is, or what you do get is Internet Explorer 6.0, and you're definitely going to want to get that upgraded to IE8. Certainly, it's essential for system access and really just for secure web browsing, and Google and a lot of entities are getting away.
Log on to Windows, password field, when.
So there you go. It is already, it is booted, and we'll go ahead and put in the password, and into this XP mode we go. What this is, folks, is what is known as a virtual machine. So in other words, you could pay quite a bit of money for some technology. There you go.
And we list docs not selected.
So that, now we are all in, when I am in Windows XP, and I'll show you very quickly how to go back to Windows 7. You have them both on the screen. So, you know, otherwise you would have to buy some technology like VMware Workstation, which is going to set you back about $179. So Microsoft has done this at no cost. So I guess the question is, why have they done it? Well, for one thing, there's quite a number of people who are reluctant to go to Windows 7 because they have devices that may not be supported, printers and special hardware. Also, some of us who do sound work, Windows 7 has a very annoying trait when doing audio where you actually have a delay in your voice, and it's very disconcerting, even doing something like a tech chat. So, you know, this is very helpful in that case, and you can install separate sound modules. But I have a fully functioning copy of Windows XP here that sits alongside 7. And then when you want to go back to Windows 7, you simply hit Control, Alt, and right arrow. Oh, well, it would help if I got the right computer.
Toolbar, always show the toolbar, checkbox, checked.
Okay, so there's the toolbar.
Toolbar, switch to your computer desktop button.
So there's a switch to your, so basically you hit Control, Alt, right arrow, and you tab once, and it says switch to your computer. And if I hit spacebar, it'll put me back in the Windows 7 view. And you can actually copy between the two with the clipboard.
Toolbar, always show the toolbar, checkbox, checked. Toolbar, switch to your computer desktop button.
And actually it's not showing some other options here for some reason.
Desktop, list, X, Windows XP mode, Windows Virtual PC, input capture window, output painter, child, start button.
So I'm trying to see why it's...
Toolbar, check off, toolbar, switch to your computer desktop button.
Let me try Control-Alt-Left arrow. Okay, I'm sorry, it's Control-Alt-Left arrow. There apparently is a difference. Control-Alt-Left arrow, you're on a close button, so this would actually shut down your copy of Windows XP.
Toolbar, always show the toolbar, check box, check.
And then you...
Toolbar, switch to your computer desktop button. Toolbar, always show the toolbar.
And then, of course, you have some right-click options, which toolbar, for some reason it's not showing, and that's the fun of live. So basically I'm going to... Something is amiss
button.
Here, but I think it's probably Michael Loft
running
here.
Applications toolbar, Internet Explorer button, desktop, list, XP size, 1.48 KB.
So actually, I am back on the Windows desktop, and I can simply Alt-Tab back
Windows XP mode, Windows Virtual
in
PC,
the Windows XP
window,
mode, and it's called Virtual PC. We'll go into greater detail about it, but I wanted to show you that it is there. It is free. There is absolutely no cost for it. Again, if you do have the home version, though, it is not going to work for you. But if you have Pro or Ultimate versions, there's no cost. Get it installed. And there's a few settings that we'll want to change, like increasing the amount of RAM, changing it by default. It wants to hibernate, and you actually want to change it to shut down, because if you had an error, you would actually hibernate and have that same error when you restarted. But we'll go into greater detail in our next podcast, 38, 39, whatever number it is. I know it comes up on April 12th, and we'll go into that in a little greater detail. But I'm not sure who dropped out, if maybe everyone, but I want to thank Jeffrey Stark in Ontario. I want to thank J.J. Meadow, blindbargains.com. And boy, he got over on us in the April Fool's joke there. and Raul Gallegos with GW Micro talking about the forthcoming Windows 8.0 and the book Sense DS and the innovations going on over at GW Micro. So that's going to put the wraps on this Tech Chat 56. And until we meet again next week, as we do every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, or 6 p.m. Pacific, let's stay connected and stay directed.